Okay.
Okay. I heard from something.
Maybe ask you guys want to talk about. I don't.
Sure. Why not? So the question was asked about the involvement of the concept of kolel and the husband husband learning and the wife working.
Yeah,
how old this is and
in general, like a very, very, very intense push to learn.
An intense push that everyone should be learning. So let's begin way back and work our way through the halacha to today. Initially, we have the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says that you're supposed to have Torah im avodah. You're supposed to kol Torah sheni mamlacha, any Torah that does not have work that goes with it. Sofa b'teila, ultimately, it's not going to work. V'gorer tavon, it's going to ultimately cause a person to sin. He's not going to have a livelihood. He's going to end up needing money. If he won't have money, as much as he learned, at the end of the day, he's going to do things that are improper to make his money. So that's one Mishnah. You have another Mishnah that says, let's see the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot. That's the beginning of that Mishnah. Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, learning Torah with derech eretz, with working. That's what's nice. Shegiat shneim shakach tavon. That by toiling with both of them, you won't have time to sin. So there are many Mishnayot that say a person is supposed to work with his learning. And then we find the Gemara. The Gemara says, pshot nevela bashuk, better have a filthy job of taking down the hides from the animals in the middle of the marketplace, which is the lowest job there is, and don't have to come on to asking other people for help. So that's a Gemara already. The Gemara says that there are three people whose lives aren't worth living, they have miserable lives. The Gemara says one of them is a person who's counting on someone else for his income. He's not working, he has no source of income, so he's always looking to see what the other person is going to give him. I don't think that includes the wife, but you refer to people who get support from parents or other sources. So, yeah, we'll get to that. So we'll get to the whole question. Whatever we don't cover, point out. I just want to work our way there. We find in the Gemara and in the Mishnah that the Tanam and Amoram had jobs. Rav Yochanan was a sandlar. He fixed shoes. Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya was a blacksmith. Everywhere you go, they're all working. They were working with their learning, but they were working. And many of them were very poor. So throughout the time of the Mishnah and Gemara, we see a practical, a halachic, an idealistic stress on working with your learning. That a person shouldn't have free time, a person should do both. You read the Rishonim, you read the Rambam, so you read how the Rambam says it's terrible if a person accepts money from other people. If he's going to tell the community, you guys support me, I'm going to learn. The Rambam speaks against that. He speaks against the judges who judge and they get money for their judgments, even though they're not getting bribes. But he's saying you have to judge. L'shem Shemaim. So it would seem on the surface that a person is supposed to learn and work. But when we learn halacha, we don't just read the Mishnah, and we don't just read the Gemara, and we don't just read the Rambam. And I began with all of this because it's very common when these discussions come up that people quote all of this and more. But they're quoting from the Mishnah, from the Gemara, from the Rambam. And halacha doesn't end in the Mishnah, the Gemara, or the Rambam. But I wanted to begin with that so that we wouldn't skip that, because that's what you're going to hear quoted. When people come to discuss this, they say, hey, that's what it says. They sometimes quote from the Torah as well. The Torah says, Shesh Yesh Yom Tavod, work for 6 days, and on Shabbos rest. So, where's your work? Yeah, so, till here, we've built up the case against a person learning full-time. And then we'll deal with whether there is or isn't the case. Yeah?
Where's the concept from the Torah says, Ishakar and Zulavan?
Oh, so we'll get to that. We're about to get to that. But even in the Mishnah, and in the Gemara, and in the Rambam, we find what Michael jumped the gun, what Michael pointed out, that there is a concept of Yisachar and Zvulun. The Gemara says that we have, in the Mishnah quoted, Shimon Achi Hillel. We have in the Mishnah different relationships that the Mishnah quotes the following Tano, who is the brother of someone else. So the Gemara says, what do I care who was the brother of someone else? So the Gemara says, because these two brothers in the Mishnah, they had a deal. One was doing the work, making money. Another one was learning. And then they'd split 50-50. He'd give him 50% of his profits or whatever percent he'd give him. And he'd give him whatever percent of his learning. He'd say, you're going to merit that. The Gemara says that Yisachar and Zvulun, going back to the Torah, also had the same deal. Zvulun would do business. Yisachar would do learning. And it's interesting that the Gemara seems to give more honor to the guy who worked. And the guy who worked, the Gemara gives him a lot of honor. The Rambam, who everyone quotes about the importance of working with the learning, the Rambam spent many years of his life learning and not working. His brother was a wealthy merchant. His brother supported him. Afterwards, his brother sunk in a ship. His brother passed away. And the Rambam became the famous doctor. He had studied this. This was part of the wisdom he had. But for many, many years, the Rambam was being supported by his brother and learning. He wasn't working. The Gemara says that Hillel had a brother. Hillel was a very, very poor person. He used to work chopping wood and learn. And after he became the great Nasi, the leader of the Jewish people, he had began in Bavel, and then Hillel came to the land of Israel. And they saw that he knew more than them. The Nasim at the time were Bnei Besera. They saw him. They knew he knew more, so they made him Nasi. So then his brother came over and said, hey, I'll give you a portion of my money. Give me a portion of your world to come. And Hillel told him, go fly a kite. Hillel said, what do you mean? Now that I'm the Nasi, now you want to give me money, now we'll split it half-half? Where were you all the years that I was pauper and then I had to learn? I had no money and then I was learning. And now you can't buy retroactively all my learning. You could have been a partner in the beginning. You weren't a partner then. Now it doesn't work. So all this is brought in halacha. So now we've evolved. We said ideally every person is supposed to do both. But there's also another ideal which is very good, which helps both people, and that is even in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Tanakh, we find that there were partnerships. You had the one person who was a businessman or he was making money some way, and he gave part of that to a person who was learning and merited for a section in his world to come. So this much we see already in the Mishnah and the Gemara and in Tanakh. The next step is the big jump. The next step is the jump to a situation where you have a person learning and he's getting public funds. And this jump really took place about 1,000 years ago, maybe a little bit less. And this jump is brought in the Shulchan Aruch, it's brought in the Ramah, and it's based on a tshuva by one of the Rishonim by the name of the Tashbetz, where basically our sages said, we see it's not working. People who are working and learning aren't learning enough, and we're not going to have leaders. We're not going to have people who can lead the Jewish people who know enough. It's just not working. Most people who try to balance both are not coming out being big Talmidei Chachamim. And if we want to have leaders and big Talmidei Chachamim, we're going to have public institutions where people are learning and the public's going to support them. Because if we're not going to do that, we're just not going to have any Talmidei Chachamim. We're not going to have rabbis, we're not going to have dayanim. It's not going to work. We're skipping the stage where rabbis began getting a stipend. That was also a historical phase that took time to evolve, that had evolved earlier, that the community paid the rabbi a salary. That was a new thing. That also evolved, but that was much earlier. That was after he learned. That was when he was already acting as rabbi, and everyone was bugging him day and night with all their questions and everything they needed. So he said, if you want me available, you guys have to pay. You can't want me 24/7 and I can't have a job. If I'm going to be available 24/7, then I'm not going to be able to have a job. So it's going to be that was an involvement that happened much earlier. That happened about 500 years earlier, maybe not 500, but that happened much earlier. But this stage really came about then, somewhere between the Tashbetz and the Shulchan Aruch. somewhere within the Tashbetz is the one that wrote this Tshuva, and this happened somewhere about 800 years ago, 700 years ago, somewhere around then. The Rama and the Shulchan Aruch is 600 years ago. The Tashbetz is about 150 years before that. So somewhere over there we start having the institutions of centers for learning, which the community gives donations for. And this was for the elite. When you had a student who was studying, so everyone sent their kids to learn a little bit in Cheder. They learned Aleph Beis, they learned how to read. And then if a kid was really, really good, at age 9, 10, he'd learn with the rabbi of the town. And if he was really, really good, then at age 13, they'd ship him out to yeshiva. This is really the way it's been going up until 150 years ago. This is about how it went. So again, the basic way structure was kids learn. This was always, this is in the time of the Gemara also. Kids used to go to shul and learn from Sifrei Torah. That's why Sifrei Torah have bells, because when they carry the Sifrei Torah to shul, the kids would hear the bells clinging and they'd know that now they have to go learn. So kids would go learn in shuls. Shuls were the schoolhouses. And then they'd learn. That's where they'd learn Tanakh and whatever they had to know. There were public institutions in the time of the Mishnah and the Gemara where people learned, but these people also worked. It's only later on, what we're saying, about 700 years ago, that you started having a situation where adults were learning full-time and getting a stipend. The Tur, the Rush's son, who preceded the Shulchan Aruch, he writes that he was getting public stipend and he was so poor he couldn't afford to honor the Shabbos. He writes in the introduction to the laws of Shabbos, he says, I always used to ask my father, am I supposed to honor the Shabbos? I don't have enough money. And if I honor the Shabbos, it's going to be at the public's expense. So do I have to buy a special food for Shabbos because I can't afford it? He was so poor, he was living off the public stipend. He was getting the community was supporting him. But listen to how they were supporting him. He was so poor he couldn't afford to buy an extra piece of fish for Shabbos. So he writes over there, he says, throughout my years I always used to contemplate with my father, what am I supposed to do here? Am I supposed to honor the Shabbos, buy something special for Shabbos? Or because it's not my money, I can't do that. So in honor of Shabbos, I'm going to have just the regular food I had all week long, which was almost nothing. So you see already the tour was in this kolel situation where the public was giving him a very small amount, but they were giving him something and he was learning full time. And the Shulchan Aruch, in the Shulchan Aruch we find the Beis Yosef quotes the Tshuvas HaTashbetz, which says it's not going to work anymore. Whoever could do it, it's praiseworthy. But most people who try to do it to balance working and learning, doesn't work. So from then on, you had for a few hundred years a situation where the elite, the top, were going into kolel. But the top, you mean the top, meaning you didn't have, like you have today, where they said, everyone go learn. Wait, we'll get to today. But this concept began around then. So you have a few hundred years where people are learning and they're being supported. The Marsha, in the back of the Gemara, the Marsha married a girl whose mother was a very wealthy widow. So his mother-in-law, she's the one that supported his kola. He had people learning. And it's interesting, Rav Hirshel Schachter quotes in his shir, that the Marsha, his name is, he took on his mother-in-law's family name. Her name was Eger. And he took it on. Her family name was Idlish. So he took her family name because she was the one who funded his whole kola. So Rav Kook's son-in-law also took on his father-in-law's family name. Sometimes it was worthwhile politically. So we've had a few hundred years where the elite are learning in what today is called kolel. And even those elite, many of them ended up being rabbis. Then we reach a point of the Haskalah movement. And we reach the point where we start seeing yeshivas established. where everyone's going to yeshiva, where everyone has to learn more. And that's a change. This is partially a counter to the Haskalah movement. It's also partially the fact that a lot of the secular world is also going for higher education, which is part of what brings on the Haskalah movement. You have higher education all around, and in Judaism, you're not going to have higher education, so you do. So you see yeshiva starting to emerge. The concepts, we start having the concept of yeshivas that go beyond the age of 13, 15. You have guys learning in yeshiva beyond that. Now, go back 80 years, go back 50 years. The Jews coming out of the Holocaust. No one had money to learn in Kola. No one had money to keep Shabbos. Go to the United States. The average person was going to Ashkama Minyan, to Minyan early Shabbos morning, so that after Minyan they're going to go to work. That's where Ashkama Minyan came from. So you're asking, why weren't they learning full time? The people who were looking for jobs couldn't work, couldn't keep Shabbos. And those who kept Shabbos could barely keep their jobs, if at all. So no one had the money to learn. You had a select few that were learning. Most of our parents' generations went to public school. Forget Hebrew day school. Public school. They got a little bit Bnei Akiva at the end of the day. My mother was in public school. My father grew up in Israel, but my mother was in public school.
Did some Jewish day schools.
You had very few, but the average person went to yeshiva was Torah Vadas. You had Torah Vadas, you had Tells, me or me at some point, but mainly it was Torah Vadas and Tells. So everyone knew that if you weren't the top in the class, you're going to work. That was a given. And then you had a generation which did that, went to work. And their kids went to learn. And what evolved in the last 20 years, I don't think it's more than that, maybe 30 years, but it's more like 20 years, is that everyone learns, so they tell them, hey, if you have potential, keep learning. And that, not everyone agrees with. Even among the rabbis, there are different opinions whether it's right or not. Some say there's hurat shah. There's a special, we have a concept that sometimes in halacha we say this is a special time, and this time requires special halachos that we do different than we did until now. And some say the way the Jewish people look now, we need as many forces as we can get learning and teaching, and that's why the instruction is that whoever could should go this route.
What do you mean by special times? What do you mean specifically?
We see. What is it specifically? Is it the fact that we have intermarriage rate over 50% in the United States? Is it the fact that we have so many people who barely know beyond the fact that they're Jewish? Is it the fact that we have so many people who want to learn and they don't have who to teach them? What specific point they're referring to, I'm not sure. But there are rabbis who say this is a special time. Maybe it's also the fact that we're so affluent, we could afford it. And they say this is a time where whatever forces we could get should go into learning. And there are those rabbis who say, who said anything changed? Whoever is cut for it, whoever is top, whoever could learn full time should learn full time. But if they're not made for it, so let them work. Now, we have to remember that learning Torah is a mitzvah. It's the biggest mitzvah there is. Every other mitzvah is secondary to it. On the other hand, we say that if you're learning Torah and someone's drowning, so you have to close the Gemara and go save him, because if you're not going to do it, then what's your learning? You're learning in theory? Your learning has to be practical learning, that at the end of the day, you'll do what you're learning. So if there's a mitzvah to be done and no one else could do it, so you have to stop your learning, do that mitzvah, and come back to your learning. But nonetheless, the person who learned got a bigger mitzvah than the person who saved someone else. Say you saved the person's life, that's tremendous. Yeah, it is tremendous, but learning Torah is more tremendous. So the biggest mitzvah there is learning Torah. And even when we say a person could go work, we have to ask ourselves, how much is a person allowed to go work? Because a person is allowed to have parnasa, a person is allowed to support himself, but is a person allowed to work so hard that he has a mansion and three cars and a swimming pool? How much is a person supposed to work? So some people say, I can't focus for more than an hour. So we say, wait a second, who said you have to learn Gemara all day? Learn a little bit Halacha, learn a little bit Medrash, learn a little bit Tanakh, learn a little bit Mishnah. The learning is so rich, there's so many aspects to the learning where every person can find his niche. So don't learn everything in Hebrew, learn a little bit in English. Teach a little bit, learn with some kids. We have a kid up the block who needs someone to learn with him Aleph Beis. teach someone who knows less than you. There are different ways that a person could get in hours of learning. I was once dating a girl who looked at me and she was upset. She said, "You're telling me that..." she brought it up. "Every person is supposed to learn Torah. My father can't learn more than an hour." So I told her, "Look, did he ever try Medrash Tanhuma? I'll lend you. Bring it to your father. See if he can't learn more than an hour. Let him try a half hour Medrash Tanhuma and an hour of what he's doing normally. I'm willing to bet he's going to be able to learn for an hour Medrash Tanhuma." It's interesting. You're reading stories, Midrashim. It's fascinating. Why not? Take the little Medrash says. You're also learning. So she came back a day or two later and said, "You know, you're right. People don't think in those terms, but learning Torah doesn't have to be Gemara. There's a lot to learn out there." So even when we say a person could, he's going to do both. He's going to work, he's going to learn. But on what standard of living is he going to live? So that's a complicated question. How much do we let him? How much is right? It's like any other mitzvah. Now, on the other hand, when you have money, you have the ability to do mitzvahs. You need to buy a little hanesher. If you don't have money, you're not going to be able to buy a little hanesher. Right. You have money, so that's what it says in Halacha. Whoever could learn, should learn. And a person always has a mitzvah to learn. And if a person is going to work, so he should at least fund other people's learning on top of his own learning. Meaning, he still has a mitzvah to do his own learning, but if a person is working and he sees he can't really, he can't get as much learning as he wants in, so at least he should fund other people that are learning. And I have people from the United States who send me every month money to distribute for people who are learning. These people work, and these people used to learn in yeshiva, and they say, "You know, I can't learn as many hours as I'd like. So I have an extra $100 a month. Find the guy who's learning, you can give him that $100 a month." And now for a guy in Israel, $100 a month is like, it's 450 shekel. That's a lot of money. So they're performing that part of that mitzvah. And that's brought in Shulchan Aruch. That's not Yisachar and Zvulun. Yisachar and Zvulun are contracts which they have to sign. Yisachar and Zvulun is, "I'm going to give you X, and you're going to give me X percentage of your learning." So that's as far as a very general outline where the Kol movement evolved. We still have to discuss the women going to the workforce and the children. We'll get to that. But just a second. Yeah.
Even if that, let's say you want to, you can't learn enough and you want to give money to someone who's learning, does that have to be more than just your maaser money? Maaser? Or is that, could that be your maaser money? Or is that...
So let's save that. We're going to have a class hopefully in 2 weeks about maaser. We have to understand that depends. There are three understandings and what maaser is. So you're asking me, assuming that we know what maaser is. So the answer is going to be contingent on on how we define the concept of maaser. So let's put that on hold. Just remind me. Next week on Friday, hopefully we'll have this week is the laws of Kibud Av V'Aim. Next week is the laws of Mezuzah. And the following week, God willing, is the laws of Tzedakah. So then remind me of this question. In 2 weeks, right?
On Thursday night?
Friday. Oh, Friday morning. Oh, okay. In Halacha class. Now let's move on to the question of the wife going to the workforce and the kids, who's bringing up the kids. Before we speak about Kolel, let's discuss the question in general. 50 years ago, a tremendous change happened economically in the world. Families moved from being extended families, living with the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, to nuclear families. People started moving into private homes with only the parents in the 30s. So 70 years ago already. In the 30s, 40s, 1930, 1940, people started having enough money to live alone without the parents. The parents had their apartment and the children had their apartment. The kids got married. They went to their own home. That's a new concept. Up until 70 years ago, it didn't exist. So everyone lived together. You had at least three generations under one roof. And aunts, and uncles. That's the way the world lived. Up until 70 years ago, that was the norm. 70 years ago, there was a change. People started making more money, and housing cost less. And you had the conveniences of an oven, and running water, and electricity. And suddenly, it became easier to live on your own. So that's a convenience that allowed people to live in nuclear families. Now, when that happened, another thing happened, and that is that the norm suddenly started becoming women joining the workforce. And that part of that is the fact that there was birth control. So if you don't have birth control, the woman spending 9 months being pregnant, another 8 months feeding, the next 9 months being pregnant. I mean, it's very hard to be in the workforce when you're nursing and being pregnant and giving birth all the time. But once they got birth control more down pat, so that allowed women to join the workforce more effectively. Add to that, the whole concept of women's lib that was getting strong, women's liberation. The women's lib movement, so in general, if you look back 50, 60 years ago, you start finding most couples, the wives were working. Don't talk to me about cola couples. Everywhere you look, the wives are working. Like, what happened in the 50s was that there started being this idealization of the mother who does everything. She's a mother, a good mother at home, and she's preparing everything for her husband, and she's also joining the workforce. And it's an impossibility. It's the Donna Reed show. It's all the shows that you see from the 50s, 60s, 70s. They make this picture of the mother who could get everything right. And she's a great mother, and she's a great wife, and she works. It's an impossibility. You can't have both. If she's working, then she has a limited amount of strength and time, and you can't expect her to run the house the same way she would be if she were home. And what happened was that, and we're talking about the whole world now. I'm not talking about, we're talking about the Western world. I'm not talking about the Jewish world. I'm talking about, in general, historically. You start having a contradiction where women, for the last 20, 30 years, have been living wholly unsatisfactory lives. The women who work feel they're not good enough mothers. The women who are home feel like they're not doing anything constructive because their counterparts are working and everyone's looking up to them. The women who do both, so they feel like they're not working enough, they're not making enough, they're not being home enough, they're not being a good enough wife. It's a catch-22. Most women are not satisfied with their lives. Most women who are within this are not satisfied. They don't feel like they're doing enough. They're not happy their kids are in daycare. They're not happy that they're at the workforce and they're not moving up the ladder. I mean, they're still a secretary. Whichever way they're going to go, they're going to feel like they're not doing enough. And they're doing a lot. It's a new phenomenon that it's normal for husbands to partake in the workload. If you go back 10 years, the average husband felt like, I don't even have to spend a lot of time with the kids. That's her job. I don't have to do the dishes. That's her job. I don't have to take out the garbage. That's her job. The most I have to do is mow the lawn. In the last 10, 15 years, there's been an involvement where husbands are getting more involved and they're recognizing that they do have to do a lot of the housework because the wives are doing work outside the house and you just can't expect them to do so much. But that's a new phenomenon. So if you go back to the time of the Mishnah says clearly the wife's job is she has to do the laundry, she has to do the dishes, she has a lot of it. She has to make the beds. She has to wash her husband. She has to prepare him the water for the shower. Whatever it is, there are things that are a wife's job. But in those days, the husband was the one going out and working and bringing the food and the money and everything else home. Today, everything's changed. Leave the life of a person who's learning Kola. How many couples do you know that the wife isn't working? That's become the norm. So you look at what certain rabbis write. You'll find many rabbis who write against this. They say part of the problems that we're seeing today, a lot of the chinuch issues, are because you don't have mothers bringing up the kids. Educational issues. The fact that we have so many kids going haywire, and be it doing drugs, or be it just leaving the religion, or the system seems like there's something wrong. So some attribute many of the problems to the fact that the mother is really not bringing up the kids. And no one's saying that's an ideal situation. But before we discuss what's happening with Kolel, let's just recognize that it's a general problem. It's not a question of Kolel. Now, with regard to Kolel, so let's take back a step again. When a husband and wife get married, there's a contract between them. He's taking responsibility to support her. He's taking responsibility to... One of the things he signs in the ksuba is even the shirt off my back, umiglimai de al ktefai, the shirt that's on my shoulders, the shirt off my back, I am going to support you. I'm responsible for your well-being. That's what he's signing there. So you say, well, if he's learning in Kola and Jesus is working, that's not exactly what they agreed to. So, what?
I was listening to the contract of the wedding after this one. It happened to be that, well, not in this situation, his parents were the ones that were supporting them. Anyway.
So, really what's happening, and this is important as far as the concept of marriage, is that the wife is saying, I am willing to forego what you owe me because I value the learning so much, I want to be a partner in it. But in truth, it's not that she's responsible for the parnasa, he's responsible for the parnasa. She is saying, I want a part in this. And Rav Moshe Feinstein writes something very interesting. He says, when you have a zvulun, Yisachar zvulun contract, so I'm going to do the learning, he's going to do the working, we're going to divide it half-half. But I don't necessarily lose half of my merits by the fact that he's gaining half. A husband and wife, says Rav Moshe, that's a partnership, that's like one being. And we each get half of the merits. It's not that she's going to get it and I'm going to get it and we're going to get the same amount. I lose half because she's gaining half. Because the partnership is totally different. It's not that like an external factor, you're dealing with someone else and he's saying, I'll pay you and I'll also get half the merits. That's not the case. It's rather each husband loses half because it's one person that's she's half, he's half, and they're going to divide the merits equally. We could add, yeah.
Nowadays, you say, especially with regards to this situation and needing more people to teach Torah, the problems of intermarriage and such. What type of kola would you recommend be assembled in different communities in the United States? What type of hashkafa?
So wait. It's only fair to finish with what he brought up, and then get to this. Now, obviously, having the children being brought up outside the house is not the ideal. No one's saying it's the ideal. But before we ask about the kola wives, let's first see. Everyone else is giving up on that ideal for other things. These couples are giving up on that ideal for the most positive thing in the world. Now, is it right or isn't it right? That's every couple's decision. Every couple has to see what they're gaining and losing. They have to look at the kids, they have to analyze, how beneficial and how detrimental is it to the children? There are couples that decide that when the kids are this and this age, then he's going to learn and she's going to work. There are couples that decide on different ages. I know couples that so long as the kids were infants, he'd work. The second they were old enough to go to school and stuff like that, then she'd work. And they divided the times like that. There's no one formula. Every couple has a different formula, and they all recognize this fact that the kids are being brought up outside the house, and they have to decide and weigh what's best and what's right. There is a Gemara that says that Torah will not be maintained by a person who's too compassionate for his kids. The Gemara says if a person wants to succeed in Torah learning, he has to be like the Orev. The Orev, the raven, when his kids are born, so the eggs are white, and he thinks they're eggs of a snake. And one Medrash says that he flies away from the eggs, and one Medrash says that when they're born, they're white, so the raven thinks they're not his children, and therefore he flies away from them. And then the children, God makes it that in their feces there are worms, and the baby chicks peck at their feces and peck out the worms from their feces, and that's how they grow up. And as they grow up, they turn black, and then the raven comes back and recognizes his black children, and then he brings them up. So that's why we say in Tehillim, in the Hallelujahs every morning, that God feeds everyone, like Livnei Orev Asher Yikau, the raven's children who call out, God feeds them as well, because their mother forsakes them, and God gives them the worms from the feces and maintains them. So the Gemara says anyone who wants to learn has to be like the raven. He has to be willing to forsake his children. And the Gemara records a story that there was an Amora who left to learn, and he told his wife, you'll take care of them, I trust you in the Chena. And then after 18 years, he came back, and his son was already a grown man, he was learning. So his wife got word he was coming back, she sent the kid out to greet his father. So the kid meets his father in the marketplace, and they start talking and learning. And every question his father asks, he has an answer, and he doesn't know it's his son. The son knows it's the father, and the father doesn't know it's his son. And they're having a conversation and learning. And the father was very impressed. This kid is a big Talmid. He's learned a lot. And as he's talking to the kid, he's thinking, gee, I have a son this age. Maybe I shouldn't have left home for 18 years to learn. Maybe if I'd be around, he'd be such a big Talmid Chacham. So he speaks to the kid and finally asks the kid to show him where so-and-so's house is, his own house. And the kid leads him to the house. He walks into the house. He sits down to eat. And then the kid walks into the kitchen. So he stands up. Talmid Chacham walks into the kitchen. So his wife asks him, what's going on? Your son walks in, you stand up for your son? So he asks, so that's my son? That Talmid Chacham is my own kid? So I was once discussing with Rav Feinstein leaving the home to learn Torah. So Rav Feinstein quoted me this Gemara. So I told him, you see from this Gemara that she did okay. The kid came out a big Talmid Chacham. So he said, no, you see the other way around. You see that when he walked into town, his first thought was, maybe I wasn't so right leaving for 18 years. Maybe I should have been around more to bring up my kid and make sure he learned properly. So I defer my opinion to his opinion. I'm not saying anyone should say leave his home for 18 years to learn nowadays. But I still think there's an aspect where he'd also agree that, you see, the wife did do a good job. The kid came out of Big Talmid Chacham. Now, again, this is all in theory. In practice, how a couple balances it depends on many, many factors. And that each couple has to decide. The question of being supported by one's parents. So, I want to begin with an introduction. There's a pasuk in Mishlei. The pasuk says, Bait vahon, a home, a house. And wealth, nachalat avot. That's something people inherit from their fathers. Ume Hashem, isha maskalet. But a woman who's wise, that a person gets from Hashem. So, it used to be the custom that every child that got married, the father would build him a home. That was accepted everywhere. The chuppah was the home that the father built for the kid. That was the chuppah. When he took her into the chuppah, he was taking her into his own home. That was how they got married. Sheva brachas, the halacha, the dry halacha is that it's when it's in the chassan's new house that he's rejoicing, the new marriage, then you make sheva brachas. Today we extend it. We say even if you're not in the chassan's house, which Kala wants to put up 10 guys every night for a sheva brachas meal, so we do it outside the house and we still make sheva brachas. But the accepted minig was that a person got from his parents a house when he got married. Now, there's a certain balance which is very, very difficult. Person on the one hand, every person wants to be independent, financially independent. Every normal person does not want to get money from someone else. There's a satisfaction that a person gets from working and making his own living that he can't get from anything else. And when a person doesn't have a source of income, and when a person doesn't feel like he's making his own ends meet, he feels less of a person. He's lacking from Olam Hazeh. He's lacking. A person psychologically is not as content with everything he owns and everything he has. And any person that tells you otherwise is either lying or not normal. In my opinion, I don't think a normal, healthy adult feels comfortable with getting a stipend and that's how he's living. It's not comfortable. Now, a person can become comfortable with it, but then he's losing a certain element of normalcy. He's losing a certain element of what's fundamental to being a healthy individual. A person is supposed to want to earn his living. A person is supposed to want that satisfaction. And to maintain the balance of, on the one hand, showing appreciation to the parents and accepting something from the parents and still being a healthy, independent individual is very, very difficult. I don't think that there are many people who sit back and say, okay, I don't go to work, I learn all day, I have the time of my life. there are people who are just unhealthy individuals, and they take the easy way out, and instead of dealing with life, they say, okay, I'll go to Kollel, it's easy. Someone else is covering the bills, I'll just marry a rich girl. So the Gemara says, if a person marries a girl for her money, so the Gemara promises him that he won't get it. Yeah, he's going to pass away, he's going to lose the wealth. The Gemara has all kinds of curses for someone who marries a girl for her wealth. But we have to recognize that it's not a comfortable situation for a person to get a stipend, or however you want to call it, from his parents. And it's not easy to maintain a marriage that way either. So you could look at it and say, are these guys normal? Or you could look at it and say, hey, these guys are just like me, and these guys don't like it either, and these guys are willing to forgo the satisfaction of living the life that I'm going to choose to live in order to help sustain the Jewish people. I was once talking to a guy in the United States who works, and he told me, I don't get these guys. They don't have medical insurance, not medical insurance, life insurance, and they don't X, Y, and Z. So I told him, one second, I'll give you a few people to interview. You think they don't think of that? You think they don't know that they're living a certain type of life on the edge and risking certain things and giving up on many, many things by going this route? But let me ask you a question. This is what I told him. Who's going to educate your kids? How much tuition do you pay? You make $150,000 a year. How much tuition do you pay? You pay $8,000 tuition, and the next parent pays $4,000 tuition. And at the end of the day, this Rebbe, who's given up all the things you're enumerating, and not because he's a stupid individual, he knows he's given all of that up. And he could have done other things with his life, but he said, the Jewish people need me, so I'm going to forgo all these things. He goes and teaches. Do you pay your tuition on time? Do you do whatever you can so that he could have a normal life? Is he getting the salary that he really deserves? No. And he knows he's not going to get it. And he knows he's going to have to live his life this way. And nonetheless, he says, so that you could have a good teacher for your son, he's going to forgo all of that and spend the time learning and then go and teach. So you could look down at him and say, how are you living your life? Or you could say, wait a second. He's given up all these things not because he's stupid. He knows that he's given up all these things. He knows how difficult his life is. He lives it every day. He knows that his wife has to go to work. His kids are in daycare. He barely has a car to drive, if at all. He doesn't have life insurance. There are 100 things that he's giving up on any given day. Air conditioning. The list could go on and on, depending on where, if you're talking about in the United States or in Israel. And at the same time, he's saying, yeah, but this is what the Jewish people need. So I'll teach these people's children, even though I know they don't appreciate me. It's much easier for a person to do things where society is going to appreciate him and look up to him. But the question is, how does the person make his decision, what he's going to do? And it's not easy. So, I'm not saying there aren't people who hop on the system.
No, I'm saying a lot of people, who are, like maybe the majority, don't want to teach. I mean, they learn and they're not necessarily teaching.
That's a problem. There are people who learn and after many, many years of learning, they decide they're going to do something and they're not qualified to do anything, and that's a problem. That's something that's being dealt with. And they're not qualified to do anything, so then they end up teaching, and they're not qualified to teach, so they shouldn't teach. No. Just because a person learned doesn't mean he knows how to teach. That's a skill that you have to learn. There was a story here in Yerushalayim. One of the Hasidish day schools had a Rebbe who was not a good Rebbe, and the kids were suffering, and one after another kids got turned off from this Rebbe. So they went to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe called the Menal, the principal of the day school, this school in, and he told him, look, this is what I hear about so-and-so, is it true? So he says, this is what I heard too. So he said, okay, we'll verify it, but if it's true, then you have to fire him. So the Menal, the principal, said, this man has 13 kids at home. I'm going to fire him? The man has 13 kids. What's going to be with him? So the Rebbe looked at him and he said, the Torah says you're not allowed to serve idols, right? One of the things the Torah says, you're not allowed to slaughter little children before idols. I understand the man has 13 kids. That doesn't allow us to slaughter little kids. We're going to have to figure out how we're going to help him make his ends meet. But at the end of the day, that doesn't allow us to leave him in a position of being an educator. He's not an educator. He's not doing a good job. So then he has to be moved from his post. How we'll help him out? So we have to figure out how we'll help him out. So same thing, a guy learned for 12 years, 15 years, 20 years. He knows a lot. So maybe he has to take on a different post. That doesn't mean that he's qualified for being a Rebbe, being a teacher. You have to check and see if he is or isn't. Many people are. But the fact that he's learned for 20 years doesn't mean he is.
But the mitzvah is to teach.
You have a mitzvah to teach. You have a mitzvah to teach your children, your right. grandchildren.
That's why the mitzvah to learn is in order to teach.
The mitzvah to learn is to teach and to perform, both. The mitzvah to learn, to teach, and to perform. But some people...
The actual mitzvah to learn is not really specifically in the Torah. It's just you teach your children.
Right.
And that's where... So, I mean, the real mitzvah is to teach. It's not really... I mean, obviously you need to learn in order to teach, but the mitzvah, even the Maharal, I think, says if you learn in order to keep it for yourself, then it's just not... You shouldn't even be learning.
So, Mitz Hashem, a few weeks down the road, it's on the agenda to go through the halachos of Limud Torah. It's an interesting question, but let's put that on hold. We have to define what learning Torah is. We have to define what teaching Torah is. Let's put that on hold. It's a good point, but let's wait with it. Yeah.
Okay. So I was going to ask you mentioned that assimilation intermarriage is a serious problem in the U.S. All over the world. And with regard to the kolels and educators, at least I found the community I grew up in, my friends, that a lot of the day school teaches only a small percentage of the community. A lot of the people who are non-Orthodox, feel uncomfortable entering the school and its community. So, it leaves out a good percentage of the Jews who end up assimilating, go to conservative reform schools, etc. Number two, even amongst Orthodox schools, for example, the Orthodox high school I went to, half of my class is either dating shiksas or going to marry them. So, even within that community, there's, at least from what I see from my friends, there's a large failure on that part. So, when you... Looking for kollels and yeshiva and Torah education, the same assimilation. What type of people should be teaching? What type of hashkafa? That's my question.
Different people could connect with different people. And I had a girl call me up this week, and she was telling me what she's looking for. And she said, I said, look, is this all of your list? Because, I don't know if it's important for you, good midot, but you didn't mention it. So she said, that's obvious. So I said, no, it's not. She said, what do you mean? Which girl wants a guy who doesn't have good midot? So I said, look, I write down what girls tell me. And if a girl leaves something out, I have to read between the lines and understand what she really wants. Not all the guys I have good midot. Not all the girls have good midot. And if a girl doesn't mention to me that she wants a guy with good midot, then I assume that's not number one on her list. So if everything else matches, but he doesn't have good midot, I'm going to have to think a few times, but there's a good possibility I'll offer her this guy. And she was stunned for a second. I told her, think about it. A guy who doesn't have good midot has a counterpart out there. He also has to get married. Maybe he'll tell me he should work on himself for a year or two and then start going out. I agree. But at the end of the day, people could get married even if they don't have good midot. I don't envy their wives and I don't envy their marriage. But at the end of the day, people do have counterparts. And the same thing is true in learning. There are people who could connect with one kind of person. There are people who could connect with another kind of person. Sometimes in the staff meetings, we have discussions like, who could connect with so-and-so? Not all of us could connect. It's halacha. The halacha says that if a person's learning in the land of Israel and he wants to leave to learn in Chutz Lartz, So the halacha says, first of all, consult with Michael Harosh. He'll say, don't leave. You can't leave. You got to all stay here. But the halacha says that you have to... am I wrong?
No.
Okay. Joking aside...
Who's joking?
I didn't see Michael Harosh written in the Tosefta and Moed Katan. I mean, you weren't around back then. So it says there that there are two opinions. Let's say a guy wants to learn Torah, and there are big rabbis in the land of Israel. There are big rabbis in Chutzaretz, but he goes to the rabbis in Israel and he tries to learn from them, and it's not going. So they speak the same language, but it's not going. He's not learning from them. So the one opinion says, so long as there's someone greater than him in the land of Israel, so let him make it work, let him learn in the land of Israel. And the other opinion says, no, you can't learn from every guy. Just because someone knows more than you doesn't mean you could learn from him. So you could go to Chutzaretz, even though there are people here who know more than you, you could go to Chutzaretz to learn from the people that are there. Sorry, Michael. Because a person doesn't merit learning from everyone. And this is true by everyone. Some guys that feel like they have to apologize if they don't show up to my classes. No, don't have to apologize. Just, maybe what works for you now is to learn from someone else. Maybe what works for you now is to learn alone. The fact that there are classes doesn't mean people have to show up to them. I mean, I like when people show up, don't get me wrong. But that's not important. Every person has to see who he could learn from. And you're asking me whether...
I'm saying in general, the responsibility of Torah educators to teach communities, you know, to prevent assimilation into Judaism, I feel like in a large part that it's failing to... it has a lot of successes, but for every success it has, you know, hundreds of failures, hundreds of Jews in each community who are disconnected from Judaism.
There's a lot of work on that. We're working on it, but you have to remember that... we're up against a very, very strong wall. Once upon a time, you lived in a shtetl, so education was much easier. A kid grew up in a certain community. He got married in that community. He died in that community. Chances are he was going to keep mitzvahs like that community. So the fact that in Europe you had very few people who were leaving the faith, well, it was very difficult to leave the faith. Just like one Russian told me, he said, in Russia, everywhere I went, on the files it would say, Jew, Jew, Jew. So I can never forget I was a Jew. As much as they tried to make me not a Jew, but the fact that they discriminated against me as a Jew meant that the second the state of Israel said every Jew is welcome, I knew I was a Jew. I didn't know what that meant, but they kept telling me I was a Jew. So in Europe, it was much stronger than that all the years. Now, you leave Europe, you come to a situation where everyone's in his own house, you don't have communities really. Even though we're all living close to one another, if I want to have a TV in my house, I could have a TV. I want to eat non-kosher, I can eat non-kosher. No one knows what's going on. No one knows which butcher shop I buy my meat at. No one knows how I'm cooking. We're not living together like we once did. My parents don't know how I'm living. My grandparents don't know how I'm living. My neighbors don't know how I'm living. We could each do whatever we want at home. So that opens a watershed of problems. You have today the fact that you don't have the community so close-knit means that everyone could do what they want. Now, automatically, you're going to have people who decide, I want to, I don't want to. All of Western society stresses do what you want. The focus is capital I. And Judaism, that's not the focus. Every set of laws you look at outside Judaism focuses on what are your rights? What are you entitled to? Your Bill of Rights. That's what every set of laws comes to strengthen. In Judaism, you open up the Torah, you read, what are your obligations? What do you have to give to your fellow man? What do you have to give to your community? What do you have to give, so to speak, to God? Totally different set of concepts. And today, when you try to educate, you're fighting a set of concepts that are being bombarded wherever you go. I used to teach in the United States. So I tell the guys, we're going to go do charity this Thursday night. I'm going to take you. We're going to give out food to people who need it, prepare packages of food for people who don't have food for Shabbos. And the first question was, how much are they paying us? And I'd say, they're not paying you anything. So what do we get for it? So I'd say, you get nothing. You're going to help someone and get absolutely nothing for it. And the guys were in total shock. It was the first time that someone came to them and said, you're going to do something good and get nothing for it. And you're going to do it anyways. And the guys always begged to do it again. And this was one of my big peeves when I was teaching there, that you can't keep training children that what's in it for me. And today, even when they come and tell a child, collect tzedakah, so that you get a prize. You collect this much money, you get this prize. You collect this much money, you get this prize. So even when you tell a kid to do something positive, you tell them this is what you'll get. Can't work that way. I had a student who started to hit me when I was teaching. He got upset, and he came up and started hitting me. So I didn't hit him back. I just held his hands. And he started yelling at me, saying, if you hit me, I'm going to sue you for child abuse. So I told him, it's okay, because in a few minutes I'm going to call the cops, and we're going to open up a report on you as a felon, and you're going to have child felony charges on you, because the whole class saw you get up and beat me. So I don't have to hit you, and I will hit you, but I didn't hit him in that. I told him, I'll hit you, and you think you're going to take charges on me. The whole class saw you attack me, so I'm going to hit you in self-defense. I didn't hit him. I kissed him. And I was holding him, I kissed him, and I told him, I took him out of the class, and I calmed him down. But we're living in a society where a kid could come up and hit his teacher, and, I mean, you're talking about fists, and threaten the teacher that he's going to sue him for child abuse at the same time that he's hitting him. Now, you're telling me we're failing in our chinuch? I'm not sure we're failing. We're up against a very strong wall. You walk into a class where kids are looking at you. The first day I walk into this class, kid asks me, Rabbi, you ever teach before? I could tell you lines that go on today in classrooms. You're a different generation. Your generation had one level of chutzpah. Our generation, the generation that's in schools today, is a level of chutzpah you can't imagine. I could tell you stories. You'd fall off your seat. Talk to any teacher. You don't have to ask me. The level of chutzpah today, kids are... I don't want to sit here telling you stories about what's going on, but it's going on in good schools. Kids are talking back like in my time you'd never imagine. And this is what they're getting trained at home. So the chinuch has to undo the home, overdo the home, give love, give discipline. It's very hard. I'm not sure that the failure is because of the chinuch system as much as the homes and the TVs and everything else that we're up against. One of the things we're trying to do is have a lot of teaching go on and a lot of one-on-one. But the homes don't participate and they don't do what's good for the kids. And to try and teach a kid when he's walking into your class after he's been up till 11 o'clock last night, didn't do his homework, he's walking in and he has all the movies he just saw last night in front of his eyes. He's seen his parents fighting. He's seen his parents talking not nicely to one another, not nicely to him. He's seen immodest things at home. Now you have to come in and give that kid Torah. It's not so simple. Whatever you're going to try to build, he's walking home and is being destroyed 10 times. It's rare that you have a kid that's coming in and that's not the case. Today every kid has DVD at home, he has videos. If he doesn't have that, he has a computer. His parents think they have internet filtering. I can tell you, when I was 9 years old, I knew how to get around all these things, and I'm not a big maven. We didn't have internet at home, but I knew how to do all that. So today's kids are much smarter than I was at 9 years old. They know much more. So today you try to do this way, that way. How many kids call up the internet company and tell them they're their parents, and they have their parents' ID numbers, and they redo everything, and the parents don't know right or left. So people think they're smarter than their kids, and they're not. And kids are being exposed to what no kid ever was exposed to. Never had a situation like today. The kids are exposed to so much, and they're being challenged because... To walk away from all this normal and without the focus me, 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 which is what society is constantly telling them, you're at the center. Their parents are both working and they're working tremendous workloads, and their focus, the parents' focus usually is not a Torah focus. Their focus is on going to the Caribbean for vacation or getting a certain type of car or everything else, and they're inculcating in their children's minds that what makes you successful in this world is certain monetary gains. So now you have to stand up against all that and succeed in a classroom where the class doesn't respect you. And if you don't give the kid 100, the parents are going to sue you. You know how many teachers get sued for the grades they give their children? And then you have to answer back to the parents. Once upon a time, the parents would back you. Today, the parents don't back you, and they're the ones that are paying your paycheck. So the system is working very hard to succeed, and I think it's doing a lot of positive things, but it has a lot of things working against it. At the end of the day, every person has to know that every person is supposed to take a tenth of his time, just like you gave a tenth of your money to tzedakah. You're supposed to take a tenth of your time to learn with someone who knows a little bit less than you. You don't have to teach kid aleph beis, but you do have to learn to chavrusa or give a class where whoever it is getting more than you're getting out of it. So you're giving like tzedakah of your time. Now, there are a lot of organizations that factor in on that. You have partners in Torah, where whoever wants could learn chavrusa for free in the United States over the phone. And you have shiurim that are given, and I think we're making a lot of headway. And considering the odds that are against us, that we don't have parents working with us, you tell a parent you can't have internet in the house, it's not going to work. Look at what's happening. And you're talking to the wall, and I understand the parents. Today you call 411, the United States, you try to get information you can't get anyone's number. You have to read it to a computer. The computer doesn't get it. I had to catch a flight when I was in the United States a year ago, and I didn't have the phone number for that airline company. And I needed to know if they had changed the flights. They told me that there was likely to be a change. So I was a guest by someone who didn't have internet. I call 411 and I tell them the name of the company. It's a computer. The computer doesn't catch. Every time I try to pronounce it, it doesn't understand it. So then it tells me, you'll have to call tomorrow. It was on a Sunday. Without internet today, it's very hard to get anything done. On the other hand, if you have internet at home, and even if you don't have it at home, so your neighbor has it at home, it's very difficult. Kids are getting exposed to a lot of stuff. And to overcome that is very, very hard. Even if you're the best parent, it's going to be very hard to teach your child. Considering that many parents are not doing what's best for their kids and many, many friends, it's hard. I'm not sure that there's so much a problem with the chinuch in the schools as much as there's a problem with the chinuch in the homes. I think the central problem today is the homes. Parents don't know how to be parents, and that's where I think the problem is focused, and that's why there are a lot of classes coming out with teaching parents how to be parents. That's what I think.